This is Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Gamley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. Local police were called to Hampstead Hospital multiple times to respond to recent incidents when staff were working with combative patients. The hospital serves children and teens in need of acute and long-term care. State officials bought the hospital last year and enlisted an outside firm to help staff the facility. To discuss the needs of staff and patients at that facility, I'm joined now by the Department of Health and Human Services Deputy Commissioner Marissa Henn, who oversees Hampstead Hospital in her role. Thank you for being here.
Great to be with you.
Deputy Commissioner, two staff are recovering from injuries relating to one of those incidents with a patient. Are there enough staff and resources available to work with patients who might need more intensive care?
I'm confident that there are enough resources and fantastic care being delivered at the hospital. I have spent a significant amount of time at Hampstead Hospital over the last couple years, but especially in the last couple weeks. And while we have gone through a bit of a bumpy period as we adjust our services and resources to care for kids who have more complex needs, our staffing ratios are high, in fact, exceeding national expectations. Staff are stepping up in new ways. And while there are definitely opportunities for us to improve, they are doing an exceptional job with the skills and resources they have to serve a challenging set of youth, but also youth who really benefit from our services as a state.
So this is a facility that is set up to serve a population of kids with complex psychiatric needs. I think it's fair to expect that, you know, difficult situations with patients will arise. But why isn't this facility equipped to handle these incidents on their own without police?
So when you have a facility that is serving kids with this level of acute need and who, by definition of being in this facility, are not safe to be in their home communities, you will have issues that arise. The vast majority of those incidents that occur, we manage effectively on our own as a clinical treatment team. One of the things the state did when it purchased and took over Hampstead Hospital was actually establishing a safety program, including a fully trained cadre of safety ambassadors who are able to, using trauma-informed approaches, de-escalate situations. They do that about 50 times a month. And so it's not that situations won't occur. That is inevitable in an environment that treats young people with the complexity of issues we're talking about. The question is, how often are we needing to call in those first responders? And the answer should be pretty rarely. And so that is our commitment, is to help ensure that both our safety program, our clinical program, is addressing the vast majority of behaviors. And in the last few weeks, we've seen that occasionally we get one or two youth who test some of the boundaries of that. And we're super grateful for the high level of service we've gotten from police, 911. But our ultimate aspiration is to be able to manage those situations and only call them on occasion.
Could you tell us more about what police are doing when they are called?
Yeah. So when, depending on the type of incident, we may have different roles. I will say in a large number of these incidents, police really aren't having to do anything other than be available to support staff should they need some additional help physically moving a young person from one space to another. At times, we've had some property damage that needs to be managed. You know, these are adolescents and sometimes can be as physically large as adults. And so just making sure that the situation is contained and that other youth are safe. But obviously, one of the things I appreciate about the local and state first responders we've had is how much they defer to the treatment team in terms of what is needed and how to be as trauma-informed as possible. We've even had Hampstead Police Department offering, volunteering to take the NAMI training in crisis intervention. And we as a state are so appreciative of that, that we're paying for the overtime so they can go do that intensive 40-hour training. So there's a recognition that we all want to reduce that burden. But at the times they do respond, recognize that we need to all take upon ourselves to do that in a trauma-informed way.
However, there have been incidents before this past week. There have been several incidents over the summer and the fall. There were half a dozen incidents of police being called, I know, in the fall. So it is an ongoing issue.
It's an ongoing issue, but I think it's one where we tend to see these very brief, rougher periods when we are having youth who are more challenging. And so, in fact, we had a challenging month in July for the same reason. A very small number, one, two youth who physically were difficult and who sometimes would try to hurt the building or try to run away. The fall, actually, we saw a significant decline, and we track these data very closely. it was just recently in the last couple weeks that we saw that increase, which has, again, now, hopefully, knock on wood, gone back to some degree of normal. So it's, I think the important thing to recognize is that just because a facility is experiencing situations of escalated behavior, even violence, we of course want to avoid that at all costs. But any health facility, especially one serving people with psychiatric illness right now, is going to experience those episodes. And it's a matter of doing the very best you can to keep everyone safe and to try to scale up your resources so that nobody gets hurt.
The state contracted WellPath to staff the hospital. Some advocacy groups have questioned that choice, saying that the company has more experience with jails and adult psychiatric facilities. So, in overseeing WellPath's work as it runs Hampstead, are you overall satisfied? Is the state overall satisfied with the performance of WellPath? Because there has been talk that there could be other contracts. We could be looking at other contracts here, other companies.
So I can confidently assure the public that we are enforcing this contract, and that, of course, when we purchased the hospital, we had a very short amount of time. We wanted to make sure the facility remained a source of care for our most vulnerable youth. So in order to do that, we had to work quickly to find a vendor who could stand up the services, the payroll, all the infrastructure it takes to continue those operations. We always did that with the understanding that this first 2 years would be a learning experience, and it definitely has been. And so as is known publicly, we have released an RFP for that next contract. RFP stands for Request for Proposal. And regardless of who that contractor is, whether it ends up being WellPath or another entity, our commitment as a state is that there is high-quality, evidence-based care being delivered and that we are ensuring access to a critical level of service that, without which, New Hampshire does not have currently any other source of psychiatric inpatient services for kids. So our commitment is that we will be transparent, that we will share data, that we will hold the contractor accountable, and we're going to keep learning as we go, but a new contract is on the way, which is also an opportunity to look at and to pull stakeholders into looking at what's working and where can we improve.
Department of Health and Human Services Deputy Commissioner Marissa Henn, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you.
Lawmakers passed a bill this week that would add certain mental health records to gun background checks. Anne-Marie Timmons is a reporter for the New Hampshire Bulletin, and she's been following this effort in the House this session, and she joins us now. Good morning, Anne-Marie.
Good morning, Rick.
This proposal is connected to a shooting that took place at New Hampshire Hospital back in November. Can you tell us more about how the bill came about?
Sure. It was in direct response to that shooting of a security officer and a former patient who had come in with a gun and killed Officer Bradley Haas. You know, shortly after that, Representative Terry Roy, who could not be a bigger Second Amendment advocate in the House, told me he's never voted for a bill that restricts gun rights, wanted to do something. He partnered with his opposite in the House, Representative David Muse, who has always voted for gun safety legislation, and said this involved someone who had a mental health record, a former patient, and had his guns confiscated at one point. What can we do? The answer in their mind was to add mental health records, certain mental health records, to gun background checks in New Hampshire, which doesn't happen right now. And it's a small group of people, but it would, in their minds, keep guns out of the hands of people who are not well or safe. A big part of it for them was also to create a path to get off that list, which is not an option right now, and to have their Second Amendment rights restored.
I mean, this, as you said, this is kind of a surprising partnership. You know, the New Hampshire legislature has been a difficult place to pass any gun restrictions in recent years. So why was this effort successful, Emory?
You know, I can't stress enough how much that partnership mattered. This would not have gotten through without Representative Roy. And he found himself in an interesting position. He's always been sort of a champion of gun rights legislation for gun rights groups. They were at odds yesterday, and they stood, you know, they really, they were pitted against one another in the debate yesterday, and we've not seen that before. You know, Representative J.R. Hole, who's an officer with the New Hampshire gun group, said, defeat this bill, let's do something different. And that wasn't persuasive in the end. And so they really needed a Second Amendment person, which they had in Terry Roy, and someone who's always voted for gun rights bill, which they had in David Muse.
Yeah, the state's Department of Health and Human Services oversees New Hampshire Hospital. How have they been responding in the months following the shooting, Anne-Marie?
They have decided to replace the officers who were the first face when people came to the hospital. This was Bradley Haas. They were an unarmed security officers. They are going to replace that group of security with private armed security. They put out a request this week for proposals, and so we'll start to see some of those come in. It's a real shift for the state psychiatric hospital. Our other hospitals in the state, sort of our traditional hospitals, do not have armed security. So this is a big step for them. They told me they have worked with the mental health community to get this right in their minds. I think one thing to really look for here is what kind of training will they get in terms of escalation, de-escalation tactics, but also Bradley Haas was seen as a friendly face to people who came into the hospital. They mourned his loss along with the family. And so will these new armed security have that same welcome? Will they be seen as part of the treatment team, someone who sees them as people and not a threat? And so I think that's where we want to look as this goes forward.
I do want to touch on another story while we have you on the line here, Anne-Marie. The state has set a deadline for a developer to complete the purchase of a massive parcel of land in Laconia. Can you tell us more about the significance of the project?
Yes, this is a really significant project for both the state and the city of Laconia. You know, if this works out, and that's a question still, the state would get $21.5 million in cash. That's almost twice what anyone else offered for this property. And so, and some of that money's already been allotted. So that's a big win for the state. Laconia would finally get this property back on the tax rolls. It also would add 1,200 housing units, you know, in the middle of downtown Laconia, according to the proposal. And so it's really huge for both. They have different interests, but they're both really significant.
Yeah, but this deal has been facing multiple delays since December of 2022. So where does it stand now, briefly?
The state just gave them a deadline after three delays, said, you know, April 22nd, put up or shut up was the quote of the commissioner. And so they've kind of come to an end where there's no more delays. Let's just get this done by April 22nd.
Well, where do you see that going? What do you think is next for this project?
Oh, I'm not a great predictor. It's been a problem. I've seen a lot of problems, you know, not get resolved along the way. The state remains cautiously optimistic, but I'll be surprised, I guess, if it comes through, but I might be wrong.
All right. We'll be watching. Anne-Marie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie Timmons is a senior reporter for the New Hampshire Bulletin, and you can find more of her work at NewHampshireBulletin.com. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.